Eric, try unplugging your thing. Just unplug your mic and replug it in. That works for me a lot
He's
of
a
times.
computer scientist.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, there you are. Okay, great.
Unplugging and plugging it back in works.
Dude,
did it really?
Yeah, man.
Okay.
I watch the IT Crowd. Hello and welcome to Eternal Dirtles. I'm your host, Zach Clark, and with me as always, Nathan Golia and Phil Bleckman. Nate, Phil, how's it going, guys?
Hey, Happy New Year. Well, not yet.
I guess if you're watching this in video, you also know that Eric Virgo is here.
Yay!
Eric, how's it going?
It's going pretty well, man. You know, all things considered, I'm having a pretty good way. Things are going pretty well for me out here in Texas. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, Eric lives about 20 minutes away from me now near Austin, and we have been able to hang out like twice because I think it became illegal to do things with people right after you moved here.
Yeah.
But I think like one night in, yeah.
Yeah, the timing of things was particularly awkward for me. I moved to Austin in January of 2020. And, you know, one of the reasons why I chose Austin is because there's, you know, typically a great paper Eternal Magic scene out here. And we got a couple of events in right at the beginning of the year, and then COVID hit, and it's been all stay at home since then. So things have been on pause. Yeah.
Yeah. We hung out and played Paigao Magic. I can't believe that was this year.
Yes, that was.
That's fun.
That was this year. Yeah. It's been sitting in my closet. I actually played it a couple days ago with my girlfriend's brother. He's a commander player. And
oh, really? That's cool.
He had a blast. He made a couple suggestions, and I'm going to order some new cards for it. So I might post a new list soon. Yeah.
Yeah. We were having a lot of fun with that. Well, I know you were mostly having a lot of fun with it, but I was actually like, this is actually a variant I can get into, but you can't play it over a webcam. So like, you can't even like really like goof around with it. Which
I think you could definitely pull something together where it's just like if you coordinate with someone where you have the same stack instead of you drawing from a shared stack,
that's true.
You
draw
from an individual one, but it would be good to only have the same cards just to make sure that the power level is balanced.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Phil, how you doing?
Dude, I'm it's delightful. What is there to say? I'm ready for a new year with new stuff. I actually am like on the more positive end of the vaccine actually being effective, assuming a new administration can like effectively get the distribution to a point where we can start having like in-person events with like certain restrictions. Like I imagine like limited capacity events or with like certain restrictions where like, you know, you are sitting across from people at a distance and can't touch each other's cards or something, you know? Which, I mean, I think a lot of people are also, when we get to that point, I think a lot of people would be happy that they're the only ones that ever touch their cards, you know?
Yeah.
You can't opposition these people though.
Are you eating Cheetos?
Me? Oh. No. What? I'm like, I'm sitting here, like on video.
It's always like Tony Loman, like eating like hot wings and touching your cards.
Oh man!
when you opposition agent your opponent, you just have to have them do like the actual magician, like fan their cards across the table, you know, and be like, "I'll have that one, please."
Yeah,
we do that. So I play EDH online with my friends, and so whenever that happens, you have to have a list. If you're playing your deck, your list has to be current, just in case somebody does like opposition agent or something like that. So you can link them to the list and you can be like, here you go. This is what's in my deck.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you play a lot more EDH than that you play any.
These days, yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say, did you ever hear the story from one of the very early Pro Tours where someone was playing Cranial Extraction? So this is like Champions of Kamigawa Standard. And for whatever reason, he knew it was some Japanese player. I can't recall their name. They knew their opponent's exact 75 because one of their teammates had their list or something like that. But it was the first Cranial Extraction variant, like extraction event or extraction variant printed, and it didn't let you look at the opponent's hand. So because he knew their entire list, he started sorting out the opponent's deck to deduce what cards were in his opponent's hand because he knew the exact cards. And it's just like, that's an angle that you could shoot on online EDH if you have your opponent's exact.
Yeah, I mean, well, so I think does opposition agent, it doesn't let you look at the hand. Yeah, I mean.
Cranial Extraction lets you look at the hand, though, and I'm trying to think of what card
it might not be Cranial Extraction.
It was
some
variant.
Some card like that, yeah.
It's one of those things they forgot to put hand on there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the nice thing about that is that, like, most of the, like, the three people I play with, we're all in it to just, like, whatever. But, like, there's no way that you could get away with that nowadays because people would be like, Judge, like, what the hell's going on here? Like, this guy's sorting my entire deck out. Like, can he just pick a card?
I played a Commander game for the first time in a really long time recently, and it was some of the most fun I've ever had playing Magic. And I think it was really fun because there was like a shared agreement with everyone beforehand about what the power level of the decks was going to be, and like people shared lists and that sort of thing. And I hadn't realized it before that time, but all the other times I had played EDH in the past, there was like a very wide disparity in the power level of decks. And, you know, at the time I thought it was just due to variance where it's just like, okay, someone has a broken draw or whatever, but the reality is that the decks were just way, way more powerful.
Yeah, it's just power. Like, it's so crazy how different it is than like regular Magic, where like if you have a bunch of people playing different tiers of like decks, like it can completely turn you off from the format, which is kind of how I got back into playing EDH. Was one, I had no choice because like the only people I could play that wanted to play were people that wanted to play EDH that I kind of grew up with. Over the course of, I guess, like 2 years I've been playing with these guys, like we've all kind of, you know, gone back and forth and like jockeying for like, you know, this isn't fun, this is, you know, but this is my style kind of thing, yeah. Like figuring out what that level is. Not to turn this into an EDH podcast, but like, I think that's one of the big things when you're looking at that format is like how it is different from every other Magic format is kind of like what people's flavor of fun is.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, I was looking through my cards the other day and I have been saving sort of like random black, like Aristocratian cards to build an EDH deck with so that we can play. And I might get on that soon. I don't know. I feel bad because I never really have anything built, but I play. But I'm always like talking about these different formats, right? And like the only deck I have complete built right now is the old school deck that I'm playing in the old school Derby, which by the way I'm getting ranched in.
What are you playing?
Jund. Well, it's not Jund. So like black, red, green, Atog. So I can like berserk my Atog. Plus, I don't have any blue power.
Sweet.
It is sweet, except that the deck did.
This is the same Jund deck you were playing before, right?
Yeah, it's like. But like, the deck did not like do anything in 4 out of the 5 games I played. But in the one game where it did something, it was just like they had like no permanence, no cards in hand. It was just like, and I just I'll berserk this. You're dead. Like the other games, I was just like, I would like play something and then draw 6 lands. So I don't know. I still haven't gotten Sylvan Library Millstone going or anything like that. But
that is pretty sweet. But yeah, just sort of like. I guess tie it back to one of the things I was going to try and loop in earlier is that like with me recently, the thing that I've been trying to do with Magic specifically is trying to engage with the game in different ways than I have in the past. So, you know, for a long time I was a Magic player that like would only play decks that I thought would maximize my chances of winning the game. And for a long time it was like Rugdelver and Legacy for me. And then, workshop variants in Vintage, and I played those decks because I really thought I had the highest win percentage with them, and I'm pretty sure I did. And there have been some exceptions to that. When like Dig Omni was legal in Legacy, I played Dig Omni for the point between when Treasure Cruise was banned and when Omni was not banned.
Yeah,
like during that period of time, I just played Mono Blue Omni, and you know, my win rate was very high with that deck. But like, I don't know. I've had a lot of enjoyment over the past couple of months playing different formats in Magic, middle school being one of them. I played a little bit of EDH. And then the other thing is that in the formats that I really love, like Legacy and Vintage, just trying to play decks that are, I would say, like slightly below the surface. So still playing, you know, objectively powerful cards, but the strategies don't align with like normally what you see in the format. So like, I'm not just playing some like Earl pile in Legacy or that sort of thing. And it's honestly, it's been great. And I think if you go in with open eyes about like what you're trying to do and like the experience that you're trying to have, you can still really enjoy the game and not have a super high win percentage, which is something that is, I would say, pretty novel for me. And I think it's something that I've seen a lot of other tournament Magic players struggle with.
Yeah, I think that like that's something that we've been getting at a lot on the podcast this year. If we're, you know, to take maybe more of like a year in review approach, it's like, like what's going on? Like we haven't had big Legacy or Vintage tournaments to really prepare for, unless we were to have played Eternal Weekend.
Yeah, well, Eternal Weekend Online is the exception to that.
Yeah, but that's different. Like, part of the Eternal Weekend, though, for at least for me, has always been the experience of going to Eternal Weekend. And it sounded cool, but, like, I have a rental account, so I can always play whatever deck I want. And, you know, the weekends, I'm spending time with my kids, so I don't really want to sit on the computer all day, you know? Mm-hmm. So I didn't play it this year because the competitive aspect of it didn't appeal to me. But, like, I've been doing a ton of work in, like, the practice room, just, like, goofing off. And people in the practice room play crazy stuff.
Yeah, I've had the same experience. It's honestly, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
I mean, that was kind of the direction we were going even before the pandemic. Was like, you know, I finally got a chance to play in an actual old school event, and like, of course, I'm playing Stasis, which is not the best deck in the room by any stretch of the imagination. I think that tournament I went 0-5, and I went to game 3 in every game and every match, and I lost every Chaos Orb flip. Yeah. And I had a blast. It was probably the most fun tournament, definitely the most fun tournament I had this year, but like probably the year prior even too.
Yeah. I definitely think that there's sort of a whole confluence of things that's sort of leading to this experience for myself and others. But like part of it is that, Nate, sort of like what you were saying, it seems like a lot of people are really internalizing the fact that it's more about like the gathering than the magic part of it. And I know that's like a cliche that people say, but it's become like very true for me this year, because I think I've been acutely aware of it. And just, you know, I think if more people focused on that, they would enjoy the game more, which is kind of the end goal, because it's a game.
Yeah. Speaking of fun, tying back to our earlier conversation about Opposition Agent, I would like to tell you guys what I found to be the most fun ruling that I have seen in quite a while for 2020. Mm. So allow me to share with you. So I was curious, if you have an Opposition Agent and I have an Opposition Agent, that means that you control me, but I control you, and that goes back and forth. So who's really controlling who, right? Well, I looked up the ruling, and here is the official ruling as cited on November 10th, 2020 by WotC. If more than one player controls an opposition agent and another player searches their library, the controller of the opposition agent that most recently entered the battlefield controls that player during the search, because the last ability of each opposition agent is trying to exile the card and give permission to play it. The owner of the exiled card chooses which effect wins. However, the owner will be under another player's control. So that player controlling the owner actually makes the decision. In other words, because that made no sense, right?
What?
In other words, the player
does
who...
Does this require three players?
A degree?
I'll put this in the more. There's still three more lines here. In other words, the player who controls the opposition agent whose effect applies and thus controls the opponent can choose to give themselves all the play permissions unless they're feeling very generous.
Why would you put that line in there?
That is
a funny ruling.
This is the exact thing. I'm putting it in the chat so you guys can see it.
I mean, it sounds like that line at the end is to reinforce the fact that the person who is ultimately making the decisions has optionality as to who actually gets.
Yeah, when you can talk about the cards you choose.
It seems.
Hold on
seems
a second. Crazy.
This is like word of command bad, where like to make the desired effect happen within the rule system of the game becomes like just incredibly intricate. And it seems like it's one of those cards where it seems like they probably shouldn't have printed it, where the things that you need to do to make it work are just like horrible.
I disagree. I think Obfuscation is awesome. But hold on, I do think Eric's right though. I think this particular ruling is about a third person, like because both of the persons, both if like you, Phil is an opposition agent, and Zach has an opposition agent, and I crack a fetch land,
library. Yeah.
You both, you guys are both fighting over who's the opponent, right?
I'm both of your opponents. You.
Yeah, you're both.
But you would get to choose which of us control you.
Right, and that kind of makes sense, because when there's multiple replacement effects that replace something, the person who owns the original effect gets to choose which replacement effects it applied to it, right?
And correct me if I'm wrong, opposition agent does say opponent, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so this will never come up in a two-player game.
I'm pretty sure it won't.
In a two-player game, if you both have an opposition agent, you just each search each other's library first person decides to search it. So if you both have an opposition agent and cast Scheming Symmetry, each of you searches the other player's deck for a card.
The way they worded around it being okay in two-player is because it says searches their library.
Yeah.
So that makes it so that you can never actually run into the issue of like simultaneous, like dueling opposition agents battling for to try and search the same library. Because opposition agent would never affect your library.
I flashed an opposition agent when someone had Elvish Reclaimered a Flagstones Atrocare, and they declined to let me search for planes. Like, so I just got the planes, the Elvish Reclaimer.
Yeah, you may abilities really are the feel bad on the opposition agent, where you're like, wow, I did it. It was like, oh, wait a minute. No, you didn't.
Well, Eric, we talked about the deck that you had messaged me and Phil about last week. We talked about last time. It's want to say like 4 or 5 weeks since this happened. But
I have been playing it recently and working on the list.
Yeah, and it gets to what you're saying, where it's like you can find a way to have fun that with like a tier two deck, you know, you can navigate your way through the format, and it gives you a project as well to like something to really, you know, and you're working with, you know, like you said, like we're not able to play with each other, but we're like working with each other on the deck, which has kind of been fun, you know. So why don't you tell us where you are with the Soul Sisters?
Sure. So the thing that I realized pretty early on was something that Phil had identified in your last episode, in that it's not a Soul Sisters deck or anything like that. It is about Sylvan Library. The deck is about Sylvan Library, because my experience playing it and your experience and everyone else who's tried it has had the same thoughts. And that is, when you put a Sylvan Library in play and you untap with it, your win percentage, like in those scenarios, goes to like 90% or something like that, just because you maximize the effect of it so well. You know, just as a side note, like Sylvan Library is one of those cards like Wasteland or something, where had it never been printed before and they printed it in 2019 or 2020, people would be losing their minds, right? I mean, it's just one of those cards that we've collectively accepted as okay, and it really, really is an absurd magic card. It's in green. There's only one green pip on it. You're exchanging life for cards, which is like a known, like, like
they didn't know what it was.
Extreme design mistake, right?
And it's a black ability.
Now it's a black ability. Yeah.
It was a black ability then, because greed is also in Legends. Also, it stacks the top of your library. It gives you rearranging the top of your library. It gives you draw triggers. Yeah. Which all these things that really didn't matter at the time.
I mean, we used to play it with land tax because it would shuffle your deck.
Yeah.
That was the scoop. You were like, oh my God, I can shuffle my deck and see three new cards every turn.
Land tax Sylvan Library, OG countertop.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't counter anything, but yeah.
Okay. But yeah, to talk about the deck a bit more, like the reality is that, you know, we tried a couple different builds, or I tried and we tried a couple different builds, like one of which included Urion, which seemed like, all right, let's include the 2020 card, and you get to play like the Screenstone Zenith package and all this sort of stuff. But when you do that, you're just reducing the number of Sylvan Libraries in your deck effectively, because now it's only 4 out of 80 cards rather than 4 out of 60. So the percentage of Sylvan Libraries goes down. And there's no real like copies 5 through 8 of Sylvan Library that you can play. There's Greed, like you said, there's like Argoyle's Bloodfast and that sort of stuff. But these cards are just, they are not on the same power level, so there's no real redundancy that you can build in. So like, you should be playing 60 if you're trying to play this deck. But you know, on that note, what I would consider as the threat density in sort of the builds that I had been trying out and the lists I had shown was relatively low, because the actual soul sisters themselves are not threats. And then it's pretty hard to like actually win the game if you don't have a library in play. Or, you know, unless you're against combo and like you put a deafening silence in play or whatever, like, you know, those are, I don't want to call them free wins because the other decks are like real decks, but it's not like game plan. It's not like a really strong game plan, I would consider it. So what I've been trying to do is increase the threat density in the deck. And I've started playing four Ajani's Pride Maid, and they have been like very, very good. That's the 2 minute 2/2, whenever you gain life, put a +1/+1 counter on it. And that card is just, it's a house. It's another one of those cards that converts life into a resource, but it doesn't actually convert, the resource. It's just, it doesn't cost anything. I mean, the quote unquote cost is you have a 2 mana 2/2 in your deck, but it very quickly reaches 10 power or whatever. And the second that you have like two or even two like soul sister effects and like an Ajani's Primate, if you get to untap, it's the same thing. Like you're very, very likely to win that game. So I've started doing that more. And then the other thing is leaning into the Heliod combo a bit more. Yep. And the way that I've been making room for that is just cutting soul sisters. I think eventually what I'd like to do is to go down to like 8 or 9, and then cutting Essence Wardens, one for creature type considerations. And the other thing is producing a green threat on turn one is not what you want to be doing. The deck wants to fetch basic planes a lot on the first turn. So, yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Essence Warden is an elf.
It's an elf shaman. Elf shaman. Yeah, that's right.
It's not a cleric either. That was the thing that
I
found out. That's the big thing.
Yeah. Because it was. So, what, do you still have. So what's in the deck? Do you have a list or anything we should.
You know, I'm not on a machine right now that has access to Modo, but I will, I'll send a list to you guys.
I'm just curious if you're still playing like Children of Corliss or Green Sun.
No. Still playing Green Sun Zenith, yeah, because the Green Sun Zenith package allows you to play one Spike Weaver, so you can combo with Heliod. And Heliod is also naturally very good. It's another one of the cards that sort of converts gaining life into another resource. But again, similar to a Ajani's Pride Maid, it doesn't actually cost you anything. It's been very good for me as well. That's also been a good threat against Plague Engineer, which has been a problem for the deck.
Yeah.
Spike Feeder for not Spike Weaver, right?
Whatever the 3 mana one is that combos with Heliod.
Yeah, not the one that fogs.
Yeah, Spike Weaver Feeder.
We know all about the spikes, okay? We've been playing middle school. We played middle school all summer.
Oh, yeah.
Which spike is that? Comes up quite a bit.
That format is so awesome. And we could definitely talk about Soul Sisters more. By the way, are you guys trying to? I know you guys typically keep the episodes to like an hour. Is that the goal here as well? Because I could talk for.
Yeah, we can talk a little bit longer.
Yeah, we're hanging out.
All right. Yeah, we're hanging out. We're getting rid of this fucking awful year, and good riddance. And I understand that the problems are still going to exist, but I'm looking
forward. Yeah, they haven't banned Oko or Uro yet. So
my idea of a good year is when I can like play Gwafa Hazeed in Legacy. So it's going to be a while.
I think the Soul Sisters deck is interesting. The thing about it that like. It's one of these things where, like, you know, we are, you know, I sort of, like, I'm always, like, Mr. Brew guy and always trying to do something. And then sometimes the thing just, like, blow right past my head. I had never thought about all those, the way all the Soul Sisters interact with each other and Sylvan Library and, like, just the couple extra cards are legal in Legacy compared to Modern that make it, like, just this much more, you know, interesting. Because do you still play Gaia's Cradle?
I think I'm playing one right now. I could see playing two.
But that's the thing. Gaia's Cradle is so busted.
Cradle is an insane magic card.
Yeah. And you're like, okay, so most of this deck is just a Modern deck, except for this one really powerful card that I can only play in this format.
Sylvan Library,
it's another thing too, right? Right. It's like, yeah, exactly.
And Green Sun Zenith is also really busted.
Legal. Somehow still not legal in Modern. But yeah, so that's the thing that makes it so, that was the thing that like, I'm like, oh, it's just a Modern deck. Like, I don't really know what Legacy offers until you really think about it. Like, oh, there's other synergies. And like, that kind of stuff is fun. And like, actually, after After you had started doing that, I actually started thinking about like the hammer combo in Legacy. Mm,
yeah.
Like, because,
that's interesting. Yeah. I
because, well,
look at some jury, of those spells. Yeah.
Jury Master of the Review is a card that I really love. I'm not sure
what that is.
It's in the new commander set. It's black and a red for like a 1/1. And when it dies, it does damage equal to its power to any target. So if you make it a 10, if you put a +10/+10 on it and then sacrifice it to a Cabal Therapy or a Goblin Bombardment, again, cards that are not legal in mm-hmm. Modern, like you can also attack with it. You could tag with it for 11 and then, you know, kill it at the end that wins. And there's like, but anyway, like that was the kind of thing I was thinking of, like, oh, like just this one little thing might be enough. Like, I don't know. Blazing Shoal is also a card that's not legal in Modern and can make your
yeah. Jury really big. Jeez, that's a magic card. But yeah. Like one of the things that I really found as just an interesting, I'd say like meta analysis of Magic in general is like playing these different decks in Legacy and playing middle school has really reinforced something for me. And that is that playing these sorts of decks in like middle school, it used to feel like when you were building a deck of Magic cards, you were really putting a combination of cards together that felt a lot more powerful than the sum of the individual cards, mm-hmm. right? Where it's just like, Soul Warden is not a good Magic card, okay? But if you play 12 of them and then you do something with that life, like, and it's Sylvan Library, like you got something going, yeah, right? And now like you look at a lot of these like decks in like Modern and it's like literally just a pile of cards that are all individually powerful, like at an absurd level. And like, that's one of the best things that you could be doing in the format.
Let me tell you something, brother. If you're digging this podcast, you got to go over to patreon.com/eternaldurtles and become a patron right now. Oh yeah.
I don't know if Magic has just fundamentally changed or if it's a real serious just case of nostalgia, but like the games feel different in terms of how they play out. And the meta feels different now than it used to and that sort of thing. And I don't know. It's just been, nice to play games of Magic that feel like the games of Magic that I used to play. And like, when you play middle school, like there are still like really powerful cards and there's still really powerful decks. Like
people regularly won on turn two. I watched every feature match, you know, like people regularly win on turn two or three. Sorry. Just saying like, as like, if you're like powerful, like, yeah, of course.
Yeah, Eric, the what you're describing, I feel like we've like chatted about before. We've definitely talked about it in like just our various group chats that I fully agree with everything that you said. The thing that strikes me about the difference in play patterns is yes, there's like less synergy based or like synergy to make your deck work. It's like synergy that just further powers already powerful mm-hmm. cards. What I found, I found less interesting about playing with those like newer, more powerful cards is they all lack drama. They all have there's no suspense to them. There's no, like, everything is immediate. And like, even with cards that like we've praised, like something like Skyclave Apparition, right? Coming in this year, that was like a welcomed thing in white, right? It's like finally white has a piece that can answer like all these problematic things. But at the end of the day, it's just a Ravenous Chupacabra, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, play this, kill your thing, go. Like there's no suspense there. It doesn't create any texture to a game. And
yeah, I mean, what I think I've called that the Jundening of Magic the Gathering, like when every card is a questing beast.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of text on cards, which is a thing that I would say, Eric, to go where you were going, like things have changed in a couple directions. One thing that Phil has mentioned a few times that I didn't really think about, but he's right, is that look at all these cards just say draw a card for no cost.
Yeah, I don't remember where I'd seen the statistics on that, but someone like mapped out the number of cards as like for each set, the number of card or the percentage of cards in each set that had the text draw card on them or some variant of draw card that was analogous. And it just like, it hockey sticked.
Yeah.
There was a, I think it was Pat Chapin who tweeted that in the original Zendikar, there were 13 cards with the phrase draw a card on it. And then in Zendikar Rising, there were 47 cards that said draw a card on it. And so just the span of, what is that, 6 years? 8 years?
Well, yeah, and that also doesn't count things that are ostensibly drawing cards. So, like, I was talking on Twitter earlier about, like, what would a white or black Dreadhorde Arcanist look like, right? Like, it has to, what does it have to do? Well, it has to attack, have an attack trigger that does something with your graveyard and you get a thing. And I was like, okay, so maybe it exiles a card, and if it's a creature, you get a token, and if it's not a creature, you drain for two, right? And then Phil just was like, that's still way worse than Dreadhorde Arcanist.
But that design too.
But that card is so good. The card's insane.
That line of text that you just described is a design that they've used a lot recently of when this card attacks, do X. And there is a really, really large discrepancy in power level of the cards that say when this card deals combat damage to a player, or just attacks. Because when it says just attacks, you get the value before your opponent gets to interact with you, because they don't get to block yet. So in a world of Uro and Dreadhorde Arcanist, there was the whole meme that going on around on Magic Twitter for a while when those, like, obviously when those two cards, they're still at the top tier, but they were saying that if you're blocking, you're losing.
Yeah.
Because the cards give you their value before you get the opportunity to block.
Yeah, this is analogous to Enters the Battlefield abilities and cast triggers.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's a very similar thing where it reduces the efficacy of counter spells and that sort of thing. And it's very, very strange how subtle changes like that can really force just different deck building decisions, where it's like, look, someone's going to cast a Hydroid Crisis in the floor. The floor is it gets counterspelled and you draw a couple cards and gain some life.
Yeah.
Like the floor is that you don't have a flyer, but you've drawn some cards and gained some life. That's like, that's wild, honestly, in terms of card design. And like, look, I know that people are particularly critical of WotC over the last couple of years, and they should be, but honestly, like, I feel like I am more well-positioned to be critical of WotC and their card design and development process than the average consumer. And the reason for that is my job is incredibly similar to what they do at WotC. Okay, so for those who don't know, I'll sort of give my credentials in a very broad sense here. So I work for Apple, and I am a principal mechanical engineer for Apple, and it is my job to do the detailed and, quite frankly, very intense mechanical engineering that goes into the hardware products that we release. And I work on Macs, so I make computers. And in terms of drawing a sort of a corollary between my job and theirs, I'm effectively on the development team for Apple. We have a team that really does the high level design. I work with them a lot. But it's my responsibility to make sure that all of the engineering is right. And we make design decisions based off of engineering capability. And we make, the opposite direction too. And I think very similar things happen at WotC, where it's like, they have this great design, but we can't make it work from a development perspective. So we don't do it, that sort of thing. And like, quite frankly, I think a lot of the designs that Wizards has come up with are pretty good. There are errors though, but the development is where the real issue is. And I am like very, very upset about the development that's happened over the last couple of years, because like, there's a lot of fairly simple like numbers changes that you can make on cards that come out, and like changing cast triggers into Enter the Battlefield triggers or attack triggers into combat damage to a player triggers, all these sorts of things that like would make the cards play very similarly, but pull the power level down. Yeah. And it's really, really difficult to see this happen. And it's like, look, at my job, if we make a mistake on an engineering level, like the hardware gets released and it goes to a product, like you can't change it afterwards. And it's the same thing with Magic cards, right?
Yeah, right.
And, yep. And the other thing
more
is,
acutely than almost every game that's out at this point in history,
yeah,
too.
Literally because right. Because of
The other thing here is like, there's also the sense that like people are exceptionally critical of Magic on social media, and guess what? the number of people who are critical about Apple products on social media is probably two orders of magnitude higher.
I was so, gonna like, say, yeah.
Right? And the public awareness is also much higher of these things. So like, I am also like, if I make like a serious mistake at my job, it has the word gate attached to it. Okay. Like, so it, you know, it's like, you know, fortunately I've never been in that position and I don't think I ever will be, but like, you know, that's like the level of stuff that I do at my job. So I understand like what's going on inside the brains of the people on the WOTC design and development teams, because I'm one of those people at a different company in a very similar position. And I think we should be very critical of the products that they've released over the last couple of years, but I still give them the benefit of the doubt. And here's why. It's because the people who are in the positions of power there had actually done a very good job for the last couple of the years prior to 2019, I think. There were some mistakes, you know, like leading up to War of the Spark and that sort of thing. But, you know, for the most part, I actually thought Magic was in a pretty good place. There were, you know, some issues. But when WOTC got acquired by Hasbro, it was very clear from a timeline perspective that things started to change. And I get the sense that the people who are ultimately releasing, who are ultimately responsible for card designs, are not making the final decisions, and they are aware of it and very unhappy.
They got acquired by Hasbro a long time ago, though. It might be that Hasbro has become more noticeable of Wizards of the Coast, which I think is actually a defensible position, because I used to report on the toy industry, like that used to be my job, and that was, you know, 12, 13 years ago now. But the point is, like everything else, it's been sort of in a decline relative to, you know, its past, because of just the way people do things differently with everything, you know, being digital and screen-based and stuff. So they love, a toy company loves a thing like Magic, or loves something like Wizards of the Coast that has you know, a customer base that's going to keep buying, you know, that is going to buy something that's more substantial than like an app.
Yeah.
So it's possible they just notice it more. And to me, that shows the fact they put out so many products. And I think that's really what's gone on here. I think they just, it's impossible. Like I'll get worked up about things they don't, especially things they say. And that might be because my job is like public relations a lot of the time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I'm just like, you gotta think, right. Things are saying through, but I just think it's like, what are you going to do? Like they're pumping out so much stuff. They got the same size team and, you know, they've also got various other deliverables they've got various sorts of like things they're trying to meet, which they always say, like, this card's for this player, this card's for this player. They're not going to catch everything. And like things that are powerful. Anytime we've done a set review show, we've hit and missed on cards in both directions. Right.
That's just Magic though. Right, evaluating cards is so difficult.
And they're able to think that's the development thing, right? Evaluating cards. They don't have the time and they're like, they're not thinking fully optimized. This is what the
time, resources, or like. The team to play Legacy, Modern, so, pre-modern. So
here's the reality.
Pioneer.
Is that so if you're actually just talking about the cost of designing and developing cards, and I mean from a purely mechanical perspective, that is like very, very inexpensive work. It really is. Because like if the four of us were so inclined, we could design and develop a Magic set from just the mechanics, so no art or anything like that, for free. The only thing it would cost us is our time, right? So for a business, that means that the only thing you have to pay to do that is salaries, right?
Yeah,
people. And then there's like art and promotion, all this other sort of stuff. Like, Wizards of the Coast is a very resource-rich company. Like, it seems to me like they are just not spending nearly enough money on checking out other formats. And it's probably because they're getting squeezed on this sort of thing. The other thing that I think is going on, and this is like something that is just purely speculation on my part, and I fully admit that, but like it took me a while to realize what happened with the companions. And this is it's very possible that someone has said this in the past. I don't know, but this is, from what I can tell, an original thought from me. I wouldn't be surprised if someone had said it before though. So if you look at sort of the history of Magic's like publicity efforts over the last couple of years, and I mean, maybe from like 2017 onwards, they were really struggling to like find an identity in the esports world, right? And they tried like star building within Magic with the NPL and that sort of thing. But I think that's been struggling, and I think it will ultimately fail because Magic is a relatively high variance game. And even at the top levels, like your best players are not top eighting every event, right? That's just the reality. So it's really difficult to star build. And it's also really difficult to make like individual cards that are stars as well, because even in like the best decks in the format, you can only play four of a card, and on camera, that card doesn't show up every time. And even if it's in the format, like it's just not gonna show up. So I think what happened with the companions was this, is that they recognized that they needed a way to give viewers something to focus on. And that thing was going to be nearly omnipresent. And they recognized that they had a really popular product in Commander where people really identify with their commanders, okay? And they attach themselves to it, and it's a really good way to engage audiences. So instead of directly porting the idea of commanders over to like competitive one versus one Magic, they replaced it with companions. And they got the direction from Hasbro or whomever the suits were that like, we need to make these things powerful enough that they show up often. And I would guess that as this conversation was happening, there was a pretty serious struggle between the suits and the people who are ultimately responsible for the cards, saying that these are not okay, like for the game, because there's no way, there's just absolutely no way that the people who are designing the cards at WotC played with those cards and did not recognize that it was a fundamental shift in the way that the game is played. Yeah. It was obvious to every single Magic player that I
from the second,
to,
right?
After, from the second that I saw them played. I still remember it. My absolute first game I saw was, it was LSV playing on Arena, and he released a video with Gyruda Ramp. And I want, like, his first two turns of the game, the first three turns of the game, it was just like, Mana Dork, Gyruda. And I just went, what the fuck was that? Like, it was so obvious that, like, there's no way that those cards made it out of the door without people knowing that it was a fundamental shift. So I give most of the people in WotC the benefit of the doubt about that like specific scenario. I really do.
Who's got lots of theories on how companions happen.
I have a ton of theories on companion because I don't think companions are, like, I don't think the mechanic of companions is necessarily a bad or too powerful of a mechanic. Like,
I agree.
The idea of, like, it had, like, we've talked a bunch of, like, if all of those companions, if they didn't give them anything other than vanilla abilities, like they had their companion clause and then just a vanilla ability, lifelink, vigilance, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then also had the deck.
I think they call that French vanilla, but yeah.
French vanilla, yeah. So if they just had the French vanilla abilities plus the deck constraint, building constraint, then you're thinking, oh, my balance now in deck building is this additional free card that my opponent can't touch that's always in my opening hand valuable enough to abide by the constraint, which still means that my deck can be powerful, but I'm not going to have access to all the tools that I want. That is really compelling. That's actually super interesting. Like, if I am a control deck and I'm told that, like, I can have a free 3/3 lifelinker in my, like, untouchable whenever I want against aggro, and I just have to abide by a condition, I'm going to seriously consider that, right? Yeah. So, the idea that you just brought up about them, like, wanting to essentially have their Hearthstone heroes and companions, it, like, that makes total sense from, like, if they had a meeting and they were like, hey, guys, we need to figure out how we can
get do this. Board. What's our version of this?
That makes a ton of sense. I feel very strongly that that's what happened on the internals. And I understand that that's speculation, but it really lines up. And it feels very real, like not conspiratorial in any way.
Well, my interest is if they wanted to do something that was like that, like if they had that conversation, I'm thinking to myself, if the four of us were in that meeting and Mark Rosewater comes in and he's like, guys, all of the suits want us to come up with Hearthstone heroes. How do we do it?
I would think that rather than us going to, well, why don't we just build a new mechanic where everybody gets a free card and they're all more powerful intrinsically than anything we've ever printed before? Instead of going right to that, I would think, well, why don't we, if our foil here that we're comparing things to is EDH and Commander, and we're like, wow, this is really popular. It's obviously very effective at selling product. Why didn't we just recalibrate Standard to say, hey, we're changing Standard so that you essentially can have a commander that is a legend, and your deck has to abide by the color identity of your general in Standard. You can still play four of a kind or whatever, but like now you can choose any legend you want. You can still have your Hearthstone here. Like that's where I would think, like, did they not look at those kinds of options? Because I think like your theory there is like really interesting. And if they went there, it makes me think that they had to come up with a bunch of other ideas leading up to introduce a new mechanic that didn't make it. And so I'm now curious, if that's the case, what were those ideas that didn't even,
I agree. And I have a couple of ideas. So one of the things that I had considered for a long time was something actually very similar to Companion. I design things. That's what I do. Yeah. It's like, it's what I do for fun. And one of the things that I had thought of years ago to help with one of the fundamental problems of Limited was a similar mechanic to Companion, but instead of doing it with like actual cards, you do it with a basic land. So when you're playing draft or sealed or whatever, you get to reveal a basic land at the beginning of the game that starts in the command zone or whatever, and you just get to use it as a land drop at some point in the game. That's it. Huh. That's the mechanic.
Yeah.
And the idea is great. The idea is fairly straightforward, but it has a lot of subtleties that people don't think about. So the first is that, and this is fairly obvious, the number of non-games in Magic reduces significantly when you get to do that, right? Because not hitting your third land drop is basically a death knell in most Limited games. And it makes for really bad coverage, and no one wants that. The players don't want it, and coverage doesn't want it, Magic doesn't want it as a whole, but you know, screwing with the fundamental variant system of the game is a bit dangerous. I recognize that. The other thing that it does is it allows you to play splash cards a lot more easily. So if you're like a base green white deck, but you open a sweet blue rare or like a blue green rare, you can just put an island in that slot and only play the island when you draw that rare or whatever it is. So I think it's an interesting thing from a color identity perspective in Limited too. And there's probably layers of abstraction that you can add on top of that. But that's one mechanic. Another potential mechanic is increasing the number of copies of a card you're allowed to play in a deck from 4 to 5, or reducing deck size from 60 to 50 or whatever it is. And both of those things really scare me. Going from 60 to 50 is not so scary. Going from 4 to 5, I think would be catastrophic personally.
So, oh, totally. It would be unbelievable.
when we talk about those, so like this is like a really interesting conversation because I'm trying to assume the position of somebody who's in the design, on the design team, who's responding to these ideas as they're being addressed to us, like, hey guys, design this thing. And my first thought is, if we're giving players a free eighth card and it's a land drop so that they don't get mana screwed, and like the mechanic can't, we can't start there and assume that it would be okay. Right. If we've never tested it in person, like my first thought is, okay, basic land, you get to have it. Cool. That's what we're going for. But the
maybe
clause
you make it
is
a waste or something like that. Who knows?
If you, I think it would be cool if you could play a color because being able to splash for your rare that you open, so you can get to play with all the cards that you want to. That's engaging for players, right? But I think that the way that you can test designs that have never happened before that are going to be like paradigm shifting mechanics. Yeah. Is that basic land comes into play tapped out of that zone when you play it, right? Just some kind of something, and that's what with companions, like the three mana cost at the beginning, like how was that not just part of it at the get go?
Yeah, I think what Phil's saying is like it's crazy that they went to like 10 mechanically unique 2-color legends that have like a lot of them have like really good text. Like Luris, mm-hmm. which I keep saying should, I wish it existed.
They have 30-year unique text.
Yeah.
Like uniquely individual text over 30 years of card design.
Which is crazy. One of the things I'm constantly astonished by is how frequently they come up with novel designs that are interesting and engaging. They don't get commended for that enough. Like They do such a good job at exploring the design space that it's incredible.
What's interesting is they do it pretty well, even without, and then it's crazy they like somehow end up in places where it sucks that Luris is banned because of a thing that's not its ability, which is like, here's a white black creature that can help you sort of dig stuff out of your graveyard, which you might want to do in those colors, right? Like I was saying about Dreadhorde Arcanist earlier, like that just gets to exist in standard and in a standard set and then come out and doesn't get changed. But like Luris, which is probably like Luris, if you draw it at, if you didn't have companion, you just drew it out of your deck, it's probably a worse card than Dreadhorde Arcanist, like just in terms of efficiency or what it's possible, or how it snowballs. But I mean, it's still got, it's not making any mana. Like Dreadhorde Arcanist is recursion and mana.
In Legacy and Vintage, Dreadhorde Arcanist is better, but that's specifically because of the cantrips. And like contextually speaking, I think Dreadhorde Arcanist is better in those scenarios. The other thing here, and this was something that I did see someone else point out, and I can't recall who it was, but they recognized that of the 10 companions that were released, all of them, except for Luris, have the design such that you can play additional copies of the companion in the deck while that's the companion. So like for Urien, you can play Urien as your sideboard card and play 3 copies of Urien in your deck. That's true for all 10 companions except for Luris. And that was probably something that they thought about as they were designing and developing the cards, right? You want them to be able to show up as often as possible. So that suggests that at some point, Luris was either 2 mana or it allowed you to replay cards with CMC 3 or greater from your yard, which is very scary considering I genuinely believe Luris is the best card printed since like Urza Block. And I'm like, with the original form. I'm talking about like fetch lands, Mind's Desire, like truly insanely busted Magic cards. I think Luris is better than every card that's been printed since Urza Block.
I want to bring up 2 points.
And it might have been better just before the card got printed.
Yeah. No, you're right.
The other thing that they put on there that is also unique to Luris as opposed to the other companions is if you look at Karuga, which is the opposing
the black
that's the green blue one. It's the opposing one, right? Luris says only permanent cards of CMC 2 or less. Karuga says cards 3 or greater. So Luris also has the caveat that you can play spells that aren't permanents over CMC 2. But Karuga only lets you play cards CMC 3 or greater. So you can't play Ponder, Preordain, Brainstorm, right? But in Luris decks, you can play Force of Negation, Force of Will.
Yeah.
And that was also something that there's no way they overlooked, right?
Yeah.
Zach, what were you going to say?
I want to go back 10 minutes, right? And talk about the points Eric was making about having sort of a face, right? Like you were talking about the online presence in the esport world. Mm-hmm. I want to push back on that just a touch because PVDDR ended up like the world champion, whatever the esport thing is. He got that. Right?
It was the world championships. He's the most recent Magic world champion.
But beyond that, like in the video game like sphere, he got like best online player of the year or something like that.
For Brazil, I think, or maybe for South America.
No, I'm talking about for the video game awards.
Maybe in the world?
Yeah.
Well,
he was most recognized.
Exactly. Yeah, look it up real quick.
Yeah, but the other thing is that right I saw PV Paulo Vitor Dama de Rosa. He was also, number 7 on the like overall online gaming tournament winning list this year or something like that. And yes, PV has had an incredible year and an incredible career in Magic, but he is certainly one of the exceptions and not the rule.
Oh, I 100% agree with your point. I wanted to get that particular point in. Yeah, it looks like maybe this was just Brazil, But I don't know. I was reading somewhere else where it was from
that's
the
VOD. That's a pretty big country.
Still good.
Yeah. I mean.
Let's say that I'm wrong on that because I'm not positive and the research is unnecessary. The other point I wanted to make is the whole face thing you were trying to say before, where we came to the idea of companions from, you know, just have four of this planeswalker in your deck to have four of this legend in your deck. EDHing of like constructed formats, right? There was an easy way for them to do that where they didn't have to even design new cards. Vanguard cards.
Yeah, well that's a throwback.
It's a huge throwback, but like they could have done different style of Vanguards and had sort of the same result. And I was saying to you guys before the cast,
maybe we should take a second and explain what Vanguard cards are, because most people probably don't know. So Vanguard cards were a feature. I believe they were in paper at one point, but they were definitely on very early Magic Online. I'm talking about like,
this was my first arena season in paper. So
yeah. So like, mid 2000s or something like that.
And also to arena. Nope. It was the older
1995. Arena. Yeah. 1996, so this is
like a really long time ago, and they basically give you like modifications on the starting conditions of the game. So like change your maximum hand size or your life, or there are some other like Vanguards that change things, but like they modified some of the basic rules of the game for you. And there were some that were much better than others.
So to give you an idea, I think Krovax was like, you start with like 17 life or 15 life or something like that. You have five cards in your opener, but all of your creatures get +1/+0. And then there was one that was like, you start with a higher life total, more cards in hand, and all of your land tapped for like whatever color mana you want. Stuff like that. That would have been, to me, an interesting design space that they could have worked in. But because you can't sell more than one of those, like, at best, like, you know, let's say you even made them, because they used to be, like, I don't know, like,
yeah, they were physically larger. Yeah, that's, yeah, I remember
but they could even sell them in a pack. Like, you could go get them in a pack. But because the secondary market can't make any money off of just a card that you only need one of, mm-hmm. I think that's part of the reason why they shy away from stuff like that.
Yeah, that's really good.
I don't know exactly how to solve that problem for Wizards, and I think that one thing that I often think whenever they're thinking, oh, they're trying to do this, or they're trying to compete with this, or blah blah. It's like, at some point, I don't know that this is that their objective is possible.
Yes,
like Magic.
I agree.
I agree with you 100%. I think that they are trying to be something that they can't be.
They don't need to be.
And
but that Magic, they're trying
to solve a problem that they don't need and probably shouldn't solve.
Phil disagrees, but maybe I just want to finish my point, because like, or you could just be like, hey, we have the most popular game in this format that's 25 years old with a huge player base. Maybe we just kind of like let it go organically. But I mean, that gets to the question about corporate desires to do things faster and match certain things. But I mean, like, that's the thing, what was wrong? The game was growing. They keep saying the game's always there. To hear them tell it, the game's always growing, there's always more players. None of them know what the stack is, but there's always more players. they never heard of a planeswalker. That's the thing too, right? It's like every time it's like, oh, our entrenched players, you know, don't understand what our actual players are about. It's like, well, then what? Like, I'm an entrenched player. I don't understand anything that you're doing on like a competitive play standpoint. And then you're saying that like after 10 years of marketing planeswalkers and looking for faces of the game and having planeswalkers be them and making a set with 35 or 40 or however many planeswalkers are in it, that like more than half the player base has no idea what a planeswalker is. Like, well, what do you want me to? What am I supposed to do? Just let it happen. Like, we were doing fine. Yeah. You were, and not only we were doing fine. Like, you were doing fine. You were selling cars. You were having tournaments. People were showing up. What are you doing?
I'm gonna hop in and voice my disagreement for how star building is impossible in this game, because before they switched the platinum pro, like,
so everybody dreams together. I don't think star building is impossible, but I do think Magic trying to be an esport is the wrong thing.
Totally. I'm not saying I'm not going to discount like the your point. I'm saying that
I don't think the changing of like the pro status or the ability to like give like players like us the dream of potentially getting on the train. I actually think the space where Magic falls short as an esport is in the way they actually manage coverage.
Yes.
And by that, I mean that there are no narratives ever built outside of this player is great, we love them, they're one of the best in the world.
Oh, yeah.
The one thing that like, the moment in coverage.
Why doesn't he just fucking hire Cedric Phillips? Like, how have they not done it already?
He does
coverage, but they don't. He doesn't work on like the internal like decision making. He just does commentary for them. And like, Phil, sorry to cut you off, but like, I agree with you because Star City Games does an exceptionally good job of star building. And part of that is due to the fact that their stars have a very high win rate because there is a larger skill differential in their best players and their worst players. Where on the when you're playing on the Pro Tour, the range of skills is much smaller, so that your win rates sort of converge on 50%. But like Cedric Phillips understands the basics of like star building, and he's very good at it.
There's also a specific thing that. The coverage team at WotC does, which I think is heinous if you're trying to get an audience interested. And that is they coddle everyone. Now, if in Star City's case, the best events are always when it's Cedric and P-Sully, right? Those two together are always the best to watch. And the reason for that is that they don't try and put on anything for any players that are happening. If a player punts on camera, they will laugh.
Oh, also, they openly call things garbage time. They're like, all right, we're in garbage time now. And they start talking about LeBron James or whatever.
The thing is that allows us as the audience to not feel like we're the idiots, right? We go, oh, that was a stupid play. And if the coverage team go, oh, it happens to everybody, we go, what, so I'm an idiot? It pushes us away, right? So the worst moment that ever happened in coverage, I will never forget it. I don't even remember what the punt was, but I remember somebody punted on a huge level, right? For a lot of money, lost whatever. Rich Hagen is obviously on coverage. He goes off and he's like, "Give me the camera, cut the camera to me." He then goes, "Punts happen to everybody. You shouldn't feel bad about it. You have to learn from it. You have to grow. We're going to support this player who just punted." I'm saying, what are you talking about? Your job as coverage should be like, that was the biggest punt we have ever seen. We don't know if that person's ever going to be able to emotionally come back after that, right? What's going to happen is when they do eventually come back, then you have built the narrative of, oh my God, they came back from this incredibly awful punt that we will never forget. And we will remind them forever.
You're right. Like, just imagine, like, so, like, oh God, like, what's a really famous? Okay, do you remember the LSV bluff with Settle the Wreckage in the finals of the Pro Tour, and like how that was a super highly controversial moment? Like, what should be happening at the next Pro Tour? Like, in like the videos leading up to the start of the event, is like. A replay, a secondary shot of that happening, reminding people where you can see the player's facial expressions, and it's in like a sepia tone with like a splash graphic over it, and it's just like intense plays, and then you show the punt, and it's just like a player like returning, and just like saying, "I've come back from it, and like I'm ready to start like crushing people again."
Here's the identity of it right now, right? WotC currently does their coverage as though every event is the Great British Bake Off. What they need to make coverage. What they need to make coverage is get away from Great British Bake Off and become pro wrestling.
Yeah.
Like, I knew this. This was pro wrestling.
That's true. Like if you have LSV doing the pump fake on the Settle the Wreckage, you have to go, wow. That was an incredible play, but we didn't know one of the best in the game would ever stoop to such a level. right?
Yeah.
But then you're like, wow, he's one of the greatest ever. That was an amazing play. You can't say anything. But that's an opinion of coverage, and that's okay, because then your audience gets to have an opinion. You split them, and now they want to watch. Like, your job as coverage is not to coddle your audience or your players. It's to engage them.
All I'm saying, guys, is here's the thing. This is a simple test. Do you know who won the last Pro Tour?
Yes.
No.
I do.
Okay. But only because that's one out of four. Do you guys know who Mike Flores is?
If you had asked me, if you had asked me yesterday, I wouldn't have known. But okay, I saw it on Twitter yesterday.
But do y'all know who Mike Flores is?
I do know who Mike Flores is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait. Did I say the wrong Flores? No, Mike Flores.
Yeah, Mike Flores has been writing articles for
20
years or whatever.
I blew it.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the other guy.
I'm gonna cut you there.
Mike Long?
Mike Long, sorry.
I'm gonna cut you. Cheaters have no place in the game.
Hold on. Here's the thing I want to jump
into. For saying Mike Long should be in the Hall of Fame.
No. I'm not. That's beyond the point.
Kidding me?
Is that they did a very good job. Coverage did a very good job of showing you why this person is a character. Well before he was known as the super cheater, he was a character well before that, and people remember him partially because of the cheating, but partially because they did a very good job at creating a narrative for their characters back in the day.
You have
so
characters.
Long is huge.
Okay, here's
well, the thing. I have a reputation to one of Phil's points. So you were talking about specifically making it like professional wrestling, and the exact scenario that we were talking about was the LSV pump fake on the Settle the Wreckage. If I were making the decisions at WotC in terms of all of the public perception of stuff and how we start building all of these sorts of things, I would not sell it as LSV stooping to a certain level. I think that's terrible for a number of reasons. The first is that I thought everything LSV did in that situation was above board. Okay. It was a brilliant, brilliant play that you can only make in a physical card game. Okay. That situation was exceptionally unique and was a feature of Magic. And you can't do something like that in Hearthstone or whatever it is. And if you can lean into that and be like after that, like the tagline almost writes itself. It's like you can play the cards, but you can also play your opponent or whatever it is. Play the cards, also play the opponent. You know, these sorts of things. It's just like, it's so easy to take something like that and just run with it. And
let me clean up my statement right there. When I say commentary needs to become more like pro wrestling, it's that you don't need to have four or five commentators all be the same person. You need to have your one commentator who's saying, I can't believe LSV would do something like that to their opponent. That is unacceptable. And then you have the other commentator saying, everything he did was above board. That was an immaculately professional play. Nobody but LSV could have pulled that off. And now you have your commentary team hyping up this moment exactly how you're talking about. But we have a way where we get to see both sides, both of which, sure, people can have. It's irrelevant what people think in terms of it's A or B. But like that is, you don't need both commentary people saying this thing happened. We agree, everything's great. It's awesome. Like
you need your heel
commentator and you need your babyface commentator.
Perfect example is this podcast, right? Yeah. Perfect example is this podcast. We're all very different human beings. Like every week, like you, it's very easy for
one of us even does the listener.
Yeah.
But here's the thing though. Here's where Wizards gets mixed up or where they have problems, I think. Their thing, and they talk about it a lot, and you can have your opinion of whatever. I'm just stating this as a fact. They talk about the Magic community and coming to and like we're all, you know, there's a lot of we're all in this together, and you know, you can, it's about having fun, it's about all this stuff. And then but on the other hand, like what sells esports or what sells sports in general is cutthroat competition that is not where it does not feel good to be on the losing end of it or to make a mistake in front of people. Like I watch a lot of football because the Bills are good. And like, you know, I see it like a muffed punt. Like that sucks. Like this guy's, you got guys go on the field, like they're on national TV and they're the punt returner. They muff a punt, they get benched. Everyone knows it. People are talking about them. Just like you were saying, Eric, about Apple having way more of a like backlash against it if they do something wrong. The thing is like Magic players, I don't think really understand just how highly scrutinized a lot of people are in these positions where the expectation is that, you know, it'll be sort of soft sold British baking show style like Phil does, and Magic and the Wizards or whatever their marketing team, wherever their plan is, where they're going to run into problems is that you just can't, there's going to be tension, there's going to be consternation and arguing, and you know, we pick up on it just in Legacy or in any like sort of any of our small sort of closed niches. There's, we know about rivalries, we know about like people who don't like each other and want to get at each other, and that's part of what makes a competition compelling, but it's not part of what makes family board game night compelling, right? You know, it's if you want to play
Monopoly.
Also, listen, just because like I'm the best categories player in my family by far. But it borders on people wanting to whack me over the head with the board when we're done.
So here's a way where WotC previously created identities that then people got to either relate to or repel. When I say Guillaume Waffle Tapa, what do you think of?
Extremely slow blue white control player.
Is that the extremely book? Is that the slow control player, right? Oh, yeah. When I say Paul Rietzel, what do you think of?
Boros Aggro, let's go.
Boros Aggro. Okay. They built identities for players. Identified with certain decks.
An excellent vintage. One of the best vintage Super League runs I've ever seen, Paul Rietzel.
When
that was awesome.
When Waffo Tapa came to a Pro Tour playing Aggro, it was the story of the weekend. Regardless of how he did, he didn't need to make the top tables. They built a character in Waffo Tapa as he's the control player. He plays control no matter how bad it is. Yeah.
And they healed a face. He literally healed a face.
Well, that's the thing. He was a baby face for control people, right? If you were a control mage and you believed in Waffo Tapa, the second he showed up with an aggro deck, you say, he betrayed me. They need to do that in coverage. They need to say, I can't believe he turned his back on every single control player in the community. And then the guy who, the commentator who's supporting the aggro players is saying, what are you talking about? He finally came to the side that he should have been in all along. And that's your narrative for the entire tournament.
It's so easy. Look, control players are control players because they like making decisions. And you know what? Waffo Tapa made the best possible decision before this tournament by playing.
There you go.
That's exactly it. That's just the coverage.
How many years ago are we talking about, though? How many years ago are we talking about?
It doesn't matter.
Fate Reforged or something.
I'm saying, dude, it doesn't even matter. Like, the idea that what we just talked about, like, we built a player, we said the type of deck that he plays, and then we came up with, like, the back and forth narrative between you and me, Eric, right there, of, like, this is compelling coverage. Did we mention a single card? Did we mention his opponent yet? It doesn't matter. You don't need that stuff to build story, to create compelling coverage. You don't need any of that stuff. All of that stuff is detail work that gives you things to latch onto, to talk about. But the actual like foundational mechanics of how you create engaging coverage doesn't need any of that.
You know what they also need is like, they do those deck techs, and those deck techs are fine, but they need more like cream of the crop style deck techs where someone just comes in and does like a whole promo for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, what they need, the thing that they can do with deck techs is find out if the person knows how to be on camera before they do it.
There are a lot of people.
That's another thing that, you know, some people are just not good at being on camera, and that's fine. Some people do not exude personality. Like we did the leagues, you know, that we were streaming leagues. It's like, who would be good at commentary? You know, a lot of people would be willing to do it, but like, you know, we want to make sure we're getting someone who we think is engaging or that knows whatever it takes. Right. Like,
I'm just going to jump in real quick before you finish here on that. Like on that point, the coverage team also, if they're doing interviews with players, they need to know the questions they're going to ask before they get there.
Yeah.
Like they just come up with questions off the top, like how was your weekend? And I don't give a shit.
No one cares. Like, also, where'd you go? Did you go see the Louvre? You know,
the questions that they ask are also formed in such a way that distance your viewer. Instead of saying, like, why did you choose the deck you chose this weekend, right? I don't know, because I thought the meta was always look like this.
Because it would give me the highest possible win percentage.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Like you
at the Pro Tour, that's what every single person is thinking. That's the only answer. Obviously,
you need to ask the questions that are going that even assume an answer so that the opposing person can either agree with it or deny it to just offer opinion. If you sleeve up something and we're doing a deck tech, I'm gonna say, did you do this because you really hate all of the aggro players in the room? Right? Oh, now I know as an audience member, if I identify as an aggro player, I'm supposed to not like this person that's getting a deck tech, right? What are they gonna say?
I think we gotta wrap up this conversation, but this is the fun.
It's so simple.
I got here. Now I really want to run like just like let WotC like be like, okay, you guys can run a coverage weekend.
We'll have the highest content coverage we've ever had ever.
I know at least, you know, there's some people in the WotC coverage group who would probably agree with wanting to make certain changes. And you know, it sucks that we got this pandemic. We're not having any live events, but anyway, I think what we got there was just saying, it's funny, we got there from companions, right? We were talking about how, like, they're just trying to do this, like, you know, but yeah. to sort of bring it all the way back to the beginning, like, we're still talking about, like, we're having fun, right? It's things can kind of suck. Like, I really wish I'd heard Lol go to the sun, but, like, you know, we've been having fun with the game, you know, picking up toward the end of the year here. And, you know, I really just, I hope that, I got to tell you, I don't know if I mentioned this last time. The call time, the metal thing is totally working on me. I am ashamed to admit it. And, you know, of course, like, I'm like,
oh, no, it's awesome. I've got a gray beard.
I'm listening to Flotsam and Jetsam. Like, just like, I'm getting into it. And, like, I'm kind of hoping, like, they're thematically and what they've promised, there's actually some interesting, you hope they go some interesting places next year. Whether that's Kaldheim being this sort of Viking world and what that might mean, there's the Harry Potter world, which could have some interesting sort of ideas coming out of it. And I mean, I can't forget, there's going to be an old Border Chalice next year. What's not to like?
Oh, yeah.
Eric, you still got your workshops? Like, get those old Border Chalices.
I do still have my workshops.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I think we are probably getting a bit long in the tooth here, but I think just as a statement to sort of make my position on WotC and Magic in general well known, and honestly, I probably should have started the conversation with this, is like...
Exciting editing.
Yeah, I guess we can do that. All right, so, you know, I'll preface everything that I'm going to say in this episode by just sort of communicating that the fact that, like, everything that I'm, like, going to say or have said is based on the fact that I deeply, deeply love Magic. And when I say I believe it's the best game in the world, like, that's not just me, like, repeating a statement that I've heard other people say, like, I really believe that, and I've played a lot of other games, and I just don't think they're as good. And I still think that still stands today. And it's very, very challenging to watch something that you have a very, very deep love for. Like, I don't want to say die, but become course. Something that you genuinely take believe is worse.
Lethal damage.
Yeah,
that's exactly it, though. Like, we start
have to regenerate.
This has been a theme for a lot of our casts in the past.
Yeah, and so, you know, and just to like talk about the history of it, like, or the history of the game a little bit, people have been saying similar statements to what I just made for years, like for at least a decade and probably longer. And I never felt that way. Like, save, you know, a couple of moments where things were really bad. Like, I was never a Magic doomsayer. I was like, Magic's going to be fine. But, like, it's like this year specifically, like, I haven't felt that way. And honestly, it was before the pandemic hit. So I'm not willing to offload it to that. So, you know, there are some serious challenges that Magic is facing, both with the actual cards that they're printing and all of the things surrounding the game that don't directly involve the games themselves. But in general, I still love playing Magic. Like, the Supreme Vintage Cube drafts, I played those every single possible moment that I could, okay? And it's because it was something that I was engaged with. And like, I had 9 trophies. I don't know how many drafts I did, maybe like 25 or something like that. And it was just like super fun Magic. You got to play, like, I got to play 4 Black Lotuses in one of my 40 card decks. It was awesome, okay? It was really fun. And it was a really nice treat and a way to sort of make up for the horrendous year that was 2020. But Wizards has still done a lot of really good stuff. Okay. Like, they don't get enough credit for the companion fix. Okay. Like, they made a mechanical update to something that fundamentally changed the dynamics of the game within a couple weeks of the cards being printed, and they hit the sweet spot in the sense that many of the cards are still playable and they're not overpowered, and it's like an interesting deck building decision that you get to make now. And the other thing is, like, on Kaldheim and that sort of thing, like, I think the sets that they release now with, like, heavy themes of, like, this is our Nordic world or Egyptian world, I think that's awesome. Like, I don't think they should do it every time, but I think they do it, and they do it exceptionally well. Magic still produces incredible art. I disagree with some of the art direction that's happened over the last couple of years, but there's still, I love Magic art. And if you're watching this in video, you can see I have a bunch of original Magic art behind me. Okay. And they're still, like, these are the original paintings. Cause when I was a kid, I started playing Magic, and one of the things that captured me was the fantasy art for the game. And they're still awesome Magic artists that are making great art for the game. And they still make really cool and interesting cards. And like, in general, the game is awesome. And the criticisms that we have, or I personally have, and I think a lot of other people have, is because, like, I think this game is so good, I want, like, everyone to see how, like, great it is. But I don't want to do it at, like, the cost of significantly changing the game, like companions or that sort of thing. It's just, it feels like it's challenging for me to watch that happen. And, like, printing cards like Uro and that sort of stuff. And, you know, they've had a lot of really good rules changes over the years too. Like, save, like, Bizarre Decks and Vintage, like, the London Mulligan, I think, has been fantastic for Magic.
Yeah, I agree.
I really do.
Yeah, I think that, like, what it comes down to, you know, in general, is just like, you know, we all love a game. We all love the game. We want to see it succeed. We want to have fun playing it. And I think that, you know, we're finding a way to have fun playing it, but there's sort of things that are always kind of hanging out there. And hopefully they'll make some changes on those fronts the next couple weeks. You know, it's funny because, like, I don't want to take too much longer. We were going to talk about, like, I've been playing this Dead Gael deck that Phil Gallagher had posted a video of, and then I started picking it up, played a little bit, and made some changes. And the cards I put in, like, I used to play a lot of Dead Gael when I started playing Legacy, as I was buying in slowly. It was one of the first decks I could build. And, you know, we went, like, it was like, oh, we should go back to playing Dark Ritual. Like, oh yeah, Dark Ritual's busted. And then today I was thinking, like, kind of want to, my friend Rob Connolly here, Eric, as you know, he collects red Elemental Blasts. I've been thinking about collecting Dark Rituals all of a sudden. I was like, I should collect Dark Rituals. Like, I love Dark Ritual.
Yeah, I was Rob's Secret Santa in the Austin
Secret Santa. Magic. You guys missed out on the awesome Secret Santa.
Yeah, I gave Rob a Red Elemental Blast that I signed. It was like a German FPB one, and it has Romancing the Stones 2020 Secret Santa on it.
Right. Nice. You also get a bunch of other cool stuff. There's a foil something that I thought was like, geez, that was nice.
Yeah, I tried to give him like every. I've been downsizing my collection recently, but like I gave him like a traditional Chinese foil Loquatus's Champion.
That was it. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, just like a bunch of like oddball stuff and that sort of thing. And I thought that was fun. Yeah.
But anyway, the other thing that happened too was like I look back and I was like, oh, like I put like Murderous Rider and Opposition Agent and Eliminate and Kaya in my deck. And I was like, these cards are all really good. Like they're all super strong cards that, you know, are just that one tier below the really, really big mistakes they've been making, you know? And it's like, you know, you don't want them to just ban everything, lop everything off the top all the time, but it does kind of see that. I think, like, for example, I think Opposition Agent is an interesting design, even Hull Breacher, even though they could be unfun. They have a lot more, like Phil was saying, tension. Is my opponent going to bolt this and going to get a chance to bolt this before it can do it? Are they going to counter it? They have some other way to work around it. And then Murderous Rider, like we spent a portion of a show talking about adventures. That's sweet. Like that's a sweet.
I think adventures is a cool mechanic, and it's really just kicker. But just a note on
it's worth, like yeah,
Opposition Agent and Hull Breacher. So there was a really, besides like cards like Moxin and Ancestral Recall and these sorts of things, if you sort of put yourself in a position of someone 10 years ago and you ask them what all the broken cards in Magic were, besides the Mana Rocks and that sort of stuff, a lot of them had the quality that they were cards that were symmetrical effects, but weren't actually symmetrical effects. Okay. So like one, like a really good example of that is like Sphere of Resistance. Okay. Mm-hmm. Technically a symmetrical effect, but not a symmetrical effect when you have Mishra's Workshop in your deck.
Yeah.
Okay. And back in the day, you used to really have to work to make broken cards broken because you had to break the symmetry of cards. Nowadays, they literally just put that stuff up front, like Narset and Hull Breacher and Opposition Agent and Teferi and like all of the Planeswalkers with static text that only affect your opponent. Like, I find that to be horrendously uninteresting. Karn. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of examples here. And it's just not, that does not promote like interesting tension in gameplay. Like,
I agree with all that. All I'm saying is that I would rather have, I agree with all that. All I'm saying is I'd rather have those things stapled on creatures that, like, you know, are so easy, they're a little easier to interact with at times than Planeswalkers.
Yeah, which also, I mean, I would prefer they're on creatures too, but I just would prefer that they don't exist. Right.
You know, it's funny too, because I was thinking about old school, like, what's funny about old school is that, like, there, you know, you said, like, there's a lot of their the things are symmetrical. I noticed the Black Vise and the Rack are not symmetrical, right? Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, it's funny that those cards, like, I mean, Black Vise has been a scourge for a long time. Like, there's not always, like, no, well, it has been. It has been.
Well, the difference.
A scourge is a bit of.
There's one more dial on the symmetrical.
It was banned in Legacy until like 5 years ago.
There's a lot of knobs.
The yes. difference between Black Vise and like the symmetrical effects that we just mentioned on like the Planeswalkers and everything that are like, I agree, horrendously unfun. The difference is that Black Vise is conditional, and the opponent actually does have some amount of involvement on whether or not it is effective.
Yeah, they have agency in the situation.
They have agency. Yeah. These asymmetrical effects on the other ones, you don't have agency. They just say you can't do a thing until that permanent is no longer there.
Right.
So no, I if Teferi's on the table, I can't do anything other than play my stuff out and hope that it's fine. I don't have any other agency, anything. Whereas if I'm playing against a Black Vise, well, if I can sequence my spells in such a way where I only take one damage a turn or zero damage at a time while my opponent's trying to get the cards out of my... Like, there is texture where the asymmetrical effects now don't have that.
I totally agree. I'm just saying. In the case of everything, it was just sort of like, you know...
There's a difference between asymmetrical effects that say your opponent can't do something versus something happens if the conditions
your opponent. All right, guys, should we, oops.
I think it's a fair time to wrap this up.
I think we can end on the note that, like, the one thing that I agree with Eric, I think WotC does have the, like, heads and shoulders above every other game is the world-building team is on just a whole nother level.
They're so good. They just continually do a great job.
Yeah. Every world is interesting.
And now that the world isn't ending every single time they go to a new plane, even better.
Speaking of the world ending, Happy New Year. We'll see you next year.
Oh, got there.
No. All right. Thanks for having me on, guys. It was a blast.
Yeah.
Thanks, Eric.
Be good.
Wish you the best in the new year.
Happy New Year, guys.